Welcome to Accurate Review. I'm Mike and your host, and this is another one of our live Q&A sessions we hold with our YouTube viewers. And this episode, we chat with Phil Filthy Granfield as he answers your questions on his time flying the F-14, the F-16, the A4, and the F-5. So if you like what we do here, head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview, where you can help us out for as little as $1 per month. You can also donate by going to aircrewinterview.tv/donate. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter, which you can also find at our website, aircrewinterview.tv. Thank you and enjoy.
Yeah, Space Dreams. What was it like flying the F-14? Well, it was awesome. I get often asked which was my favorite airplane, and the F-14 was my favorite airplane. But I'm glad that I got the opportunity to fly the F-4. I was in one of the last U.S. Navy squadrons that flew the F-4. When I got into the F-4, there were only 4 squadrons left. So I did a tour there as a young pilot. Loved flying the F-4. Again, I'm glad I got that opportunity, but it doesn't really compare to the F-14. F-14 was bigger. Although it wasn't faster, the F-4 was faster than the F-14, but the F-14 just had much better performance, turn performance, longer legs, more weapons. So the F-14 was a dream to fly, put it that way. Reading on down, John Ellis has asked me which models did I fly. The F-14, I flew primarily the F-14A. And if you're familiar with that, it had the TF-30 engines, which were very stall-prone. And so most of my time was in the F-14A. In my command tour, VF-154, the squadron I was in, VF-51, we flew F-14As. And then in my air wing commander tour, I flew F-14Bs with VF-102. And the only difference there really was the engines. The radar system was all the same. But I can tell you, it was kind of a funny story, I think. I was in Japan, VF-154, and we were doing an air show, a static display at the Singapore air show, where I was standing by the airplane answering questions, and a young kid came up to me, and he was from Malaysia. He was about 10 years old, and he had never seen an F-14 before, but he had built a model of one. And he looked at my airplane, and he said, "This is an F-14B, isn't it?" I said, "Well, no, it's actually an A. Why do you think it's a B?" And he pointed to a small door on the left side of the airplane called a gun gas purge door that allowed gas to exit from the gun port. And he said, "That door is only on an F-14B. Then I corrected him. I said, "Well, that mod is actually on the A." But I was amazed that a young kid from Malaysia had never seen the airplane before, and he knew that from building a model. So again, my time was mostly in the A, but a bit of time in the B. In the F-4, I flew the F-4J, and then the ship I was on, we actually then got upgraded to the S, which was a heavier model, and it had leading-edge slats. But it was a heavier airplane, and we were flying off the USS Coral Sea, and because of the extra weight, wind over the deck became a problem. So we transitioned from our brand new F-4Ss to the F-4N, which the reserves were flying. And it was a much older airplane, pulse-only radar, hard wing, no leading edge slats anymore, so it didn't turn as well, but it was a much faster airplane. And then the F-18, I flew the F-18 A and C, single-seat versions, except in training. I never flew the Super Hornet. Hey, scrolling on down. Jim Ellis is asking, at Space Dreams, is asking about the wing sweep. That obviously made the airplane unique. The way we usually flew it was in auto. So you selected auto on the throttle, and then the wings would program themselves based upon airspeed and angle of attack. And that's how you flew the airplane most of the time. Whenever you see an F-14 in a video coming into the brake or going particularly fast, it's because the wings are swept back automatically, or not automatically, you sweep them back manually so the wings sweep back. And then when you enter the brake and you turn to slow down, you put the wings in auto, and as the airplane slows down, the wings come out. So generally speaking, you flew the airplane with the wings in auto, unless you were flying in close formation, then you swept them back manually.
Phil, just quickly interrupt you there. You've missed a few questions at the top because the bar goes straight down when the questions come in. If you scroll up, there's one from Miko. And just go from there, if you know. And there's one from John Ellis as well.
Okay, I did skip a bunch here. Which rounds did you fly at for EB? Double Vision. Brian, somebody makes a comment about the checklist for the 172. Here's my pocket checklist for the F-14. And here's the one for the F-18. You can see that it's a big difference between those two as well. Okay, comments about Double Vision checklists. This is all about getting it sorted out. Okay, John Ellis is asking me, do you think the F-14 would have been unsafe without the rigorous NATOPS checklist process? Well, I would suggest that any airplane would be. In naval aviation, there was no safety procedures back in the 50s, and we crashed a lot of airplanes and killed a lot of people. And then we instituted what's called the NATOPS program, which stands for Naval Aviation Training and Operation Procedure Standardization, I think is what it stands for. So now every airplane in the Navy and arguably every airplane in the world uses a checklist. So we use it routinely. I never flew without this checklist. If you're a pilot, don't fly without your checklist. Okay, sound. Okay, question about for Miko. Have I ever experienced a falling leaf departure from controlled flight in F-18? I never did, although I have heard about it. The F-18 is a very forgiving airplane in that it is all fly-by-wire, and it takes a lot of time to understand or to get a feel for your airspeed and your G, because unlike an F-14 or an F-4 or any other airplane, you can't really feel the difference. The stick is always tripped out to 1G of flight. So as you're pulling G, and you've got G in the airplane, as the G starts to bleed off, and the F-14, F-4, you can feel that in the stick. And the F-18, because it's fly-by-wire, in the leading edge flaps, the leading edge slats, the trailing edge flaps are always moving when the flight controls are in auto, so you can't really feel that as well. So it takes a lot more looking at your airspeed and your altitude to understand what the energy level is on the airplane, what your airspeed is. Because of that, you can get trapped with the nose high, decreasing airspeed more easily. And if you get caught that way, then you get caught in with this falling leaf maneuver, which is real, but it didn't really happen all that often. And you just can't get out of it. You don't have enough power to get the angle of attack off the airplane, and you can't get the nose down to get the angle of attack off the airplane, so you're kind of stuck there. But it never happened to me. That same phenomenon can happen in an F5 as well. Okay, scrolling down. Did you ever have an engine failure on the F-14 or a wing failure? That's a question to Space Dreams. The answer is in the F-14, yes. I had several single-engine landings, primarily driven by because of the TF-30s, if you had a lot of angle attack on the airplane and you move the throttles around a lot, you could get a compressor stall fairly easily with flame coming out the front and the back. But the airplane had two engines. It flew fine with one engine. You had to trim it out, and you had to be careful because you had some fuel transfer issues could crop up. But a single-engine F-14 is all flyable. And I landed on the ship, single-engine F-14, when I was in LSO on the back of the ship. I waved a lot of airplanes that were single-engine. So it does happen. It's great to have two engines, particularly when you're flying off of an aircraft carrier. A-7s, I saw A-7s eject around the ship because they lost an engine in close. The F-35 only has one engine. Personally, I think that's an issue. So losing an engine in an F-14 was not that uncommon. Well, I would say it's common, but it did happen. On the other hand, wing failure, very uncommon. It never happened to me, but there's a classic picture. If you Google it, you can probably find it. They call it the X-Wing Fighter with an F-14 with one wing out and one wing back. So that has happened at least once, but there's an interconnecting rod between the two wings and the wing pivot points that was robust. So having a wing failure was very rare. And then also there was a mode, if you selected auto with the switch on the throttle, you could always pick up a handle and move the wings forward manually. So it was a smart system, but it also had a lot of backup, and it was never really a problem getting the wings out. A bigger problem was if you were no flaps. So if you couldn't get your flaps down for some reason and you had to land in the ship, so you had your wings out and your flaps up, your landing speed was fast, and that was a problem. In fact, I think if you look at the book, maybe you weren't allowed to land on the ship with the wings out and the flaps up. Okay, scrolling on down. Question about my call sign from Craigie. Good call sign. I get asked that a lot. My call sign was Filthy, partly because my first name is Phil, I think. But when I was in the F-4 training squadron, out to lunch at a CD establishment, I'll admit, and we were just having lunch, and one of my flight instructors looked at me, and his call sign was Nasty. And he said, Filthy, that should be you. You should be Filthy. And it stuck, and I've been Filthy ever since. And people still call me that today. A story about call signs is you weren't allowed to pick your own, at least in the U.S. Navy. I suspect that that's true in other militaries. So a story I like to tell is a friend of mine checked into his first squadron, and he checked in with a commanding officer, and he introduced himself, and he said, my call sign is Shark. And the SEAL laughed at him and said, Shark, your call sign is now Minnow. And he became Minnow that day, and he's still Minnow today. So you have to be careful with call signs. So, yeah, we could talk a long time about different call signs, but you can't pick your own. I didn't pick mine. It got given to me, and it stuck. Could the F-14 go longer at Mach 1 than, say, the F-4? Yes, because it carried more fuel. But in my experience with the F-4, particularly the F-4N, because it was lighter and cleaner, had a thinner wing, it was a faster airplane than the F-14. And there were guys that got a Mach 2 pin in an F-4 by going Mach 2. More often than guys in the F-14. But particularly on a maintenance profile, which you had to then accelerate, I think it was to about Mach 1.4 to test some different systems. It took a long time to get to Mach 1.4, and it takes a lot of gas. So in the real-world environment, you could get to Mach 1.8, but you're not going to stay there very long. Nominally, 5 or 10 minutes. I never did the math, but somebody told me that if you took off in full afterburner with no external fuel tanks and stayed in full afterburner, you'd be out of gas in about 12 or 15 minutes. Which actually is a good point about fighter design in general, is my opinion, and I'm not an aerodynamicist, but a good fighter is one that accelerates quickly, but not necessarily one with the highest top speed. If you look at the history of combat from the current engagements in Afghanistan over Syria, Desert Storm, Vietnam, very rarely do engagements happen at supersonic speeds. You want to get there, but you don't need to stay there necessarily. So Christine asked me, as a Navy pilot, what do you think of the Queen Elizabeth? You mean the ship, the Queen Elizabeth? If that's the question, I think it's awesome. I was sorry to see that the UK got rid of their aircraft carriers for a few years. I'm glad to see them back. You may know that the Brits invented the angled deck. They invented the Fresnel lens. They basically invented carrier aviation. The first strike against the land from a ship was back in World War I off of a UK carrier. So I think it's great that the Brits are back. The F-35 is going to be an awesome machine, although there are limitations with the V-stall version, the F-35B, that's going to be flying up the Queen Elizabeth. It just won't have the range of the A or the C, but it's great to see the Brits back in the business. John Ellis, you're like being referred to as CAG. Absolutely. CAG stands for Carrier Air Group Commander, which is actually an older term. We used to call them air groups. Now they're called air wings. So I'm proud of the fact that I got to be a CAG. Some guys today even call me CAG. Some of my commanding officers that worked for me when I was CAG made Admiral. I never made Admiral. And they still call me CAG. I call them Admiral. Yeah, and Christine just confirms that she's asking about the HMS Queen Elizabeth. Again, great. DYG asked me, did I ever fly in an air show? My answer to that is sort of. I did not ever fly the dynamic demo that you've seen on a YouTube video or at an air show leading off to the Blue Angels. But when I was in an air wing, I was a designated air wing lead for the air wing air show. So my job was to open the air show with a supersonic flyby pass at about 200 feet, supersonic past the aircraft carrier, sonic boom, and that's how we opened up the show. And that was my job. And I flew, I was a lieutenant commander at the time, but I flew with then the CAG who loved it, and he always wanted us to go supersonic. And every time we did, we generally broke something on the ship, either popped a window out of a helicopter. One time we cracked the window on the flight deck crane. There's a story of a supersonic flyby of a Navy cargo ship, and the shockwave popped the hangar bay doors off of their rails. So I did do that. I did supersonic flybys of the ship. I also got to lead. This was kind of fun. It was in Hawaii. And it was for a change of command for a four-star admiral change of command in Pearl Harbor. So I led a formation of a diamond of diamonds. So 16 airplanes, four diamond formation. And we flew past Waikiki Beach over the Honolulu Airport. And then we flew right over top of the change of command ceremony that was happening to be on the back of a battleship and flew by there. So I'm not an air show pilot, but I have done some supersonic flybys and some formation stuff, but I never got to fly that dynamic demo that you see at air shows. A lot of my friends have done that. It's a great airplane for an air show, and I would argue since the F-14 was sunsetted in 2006, that air shows aren't the same since F-18s just don't compare, in my opinion. Would you mind comparing flying in your day to flying done today by Navy pilots? That's a great question. The tactics have evolved. There's a lot more intel involved. Not intel, it's not the right word, but a lot of networking of weapons. If you've heard about network weapons where one, you could share your radar contacts between airplanes. One airplane can shoot a missile based upon the other one's radar contact, that sort of thing. We didn't do that kind of stuff in the day. We could share radar contacts or data link contacts, but the whole concept of network censored weapons is that's new, and I didn't deal with that. I was involved in the Desert Storm era, so we did have GPS bombs and laser guided bombs on the F-14, so I'm familiar with that. So that hasn't changed very much. The biggest difference in how the guys today have been fighting the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria that I didn't do, is they do a lot of basically close air support, where the F-18s are not training to an air-to-air mission, not trying to shoot down MiGs, but they're protecting guys on the ground. And that's primarily what most of the missions have been. I did some of that, but not to the extent that they've done it today. The biggest change probably is back in my day, you could, it was a lot more freedom. We flew a lot across countries. We could get experience by flying around the country, going to different places. We did a lot of dissimilar detachments. We went up to Canada to fight against the F-18s and F-104s, and we would go to different Air Force bases to fight the F-15s. That doesn't happen as much as it used to. The guys say they don't fly as much as we did back in the day. But the flying's still great. The camaraderie's still there. The missions have changed to some degree, like I described, but the basics are all still the same. I'd do it all over again if I could, that's for sure. Okay. Would the F-14 still have been competitive today, DACTA F-14 against SU-27? Good question. If you've seen the SU-27 fly, the Cobra maneuver in particular, that air show stuff, if you took a well-flown, clean F-14 B or D against an SU-27 or an F-15, without looking at the numbers, I would say the F-14 would still be competitive in a dogfight against those airplanes. Keep in mind that those airshow airplanes are lightly loaded, flown by professionals, so it comes down a lot to the experience and the ability of the pilots. When the F-14 was retired, in my opinion, it was still a quality airplane that could do its mission. In fact, I said in my interview that it would have been a great platform for the last 10 years of Afghanistan and Iraq. Excuse me. Because longer legs carried more bombs. It was a great airplane even when it was retired. So if it happened today, it gets you as an SU-27. The other thing is, yes, the F-14 carried Phoenix missiles, launch and leave, active radar, longer range. It would still be competitive today. So Space Dreams asks again, is it correct that you have to apply right rudder on an engine out carrier takeoff in the F-14, otherwise it would flip? Basically, yes. And that was the problem with the F-14 was the engines were about 8 feet apart. And if you have one of them in full afterburner and one of them is stalled, you get a lot of yaw. So if you don't get that opposite rudder in quickly, what happens is the airplane stalls, and then when it stalls, it drops and basically flips over, as you describe it. So that's true. So the first thing you did on a catch shot in the F-14 is you look down at the gauges for the afterburner, the turkey feather gauges. And when I went down the catapult shot, I kept my eyes on those things. And if one of them started to go, you had to get that opposite rudder in right away. Or you could have that problem. I was asked a question the other day of the F-14, the F-4, and the F-18, which one is the most challenging to fly a catapult shot? And my answer was the F-4. Because in the F-4, the technique was when you were ready in the shuttle and before you got launched, full afterburner had to stick all the way back. And then as the airplane rotated off the cat, you had to push the stick forward to catch that at the angle of attack that you wanted. In the F-14, you didn't have to have the stick all the way back. You sort of kept the stick neutral. You had lots of wing out there, and it flew away more gently, if you will, than the F-4 did. And the F-18, if you notice the videos, the pilot's hand is up on the handrail, not on the stick or on his leg. So the airplane goes down the catapult shot, and it automatically rotates to that capture angle of attack before the pilot's hand comes down and grabs the stick. So a catch shot in the F-18 is flown by the airplane, and there's not as much pilot input to make all that happen. Hey, Craigie Boy, great question. Do you enjoy the different tail art? Everything seems so plain today. Absolutely agree with you. It was always a big deal. And in my day, you were allowed to paint up one airplane with your colors, just on the tail. And the designs changed throughout the years. COs would come in and like to change their designs. And you could always paint them in a tactical color. But one airplane, we always kept in colors, not just muted grays. But that was only one airplane. We're only allowed to do with one airplane. And the Air Force didn't even do that. The Air Force was much more boring than we were. There were experiments back in the day in the early 80s with tactical paint schemes, trying different camouflages, if you will. But in terms of showbirds, the Navy only did that a little bit. The Air Force never really did. There's one classic airplane. You could maybe find a picture of it from the Dam Busters out in my Japan Air Wing. Called a Chippy Ho, and it was painted up like an eagle. It was a beautiful airplane. It was real art. It was just on their one airplane. So see if anybody's out there, see if you can find a picture of the Dam Busters airplane painted like an eagle. But I agree with you. We should make the airplanes look nice. Eric Johnson, thanks for your service. Hey, like I said, I'd do it all over again. I can't believe they paid me for it. John Ellis is asking, do you remember the VF-101 dual compressors all flame out mishap? Oh, it was no sign of lost airspeed. I don't know which one in particular that was. There have been lots of engine flame outs. I'm trying to think of a particular dual compressor stall. I've had single compressor stalls. I had an engine snuff out stop. I was joining on a tanker at high altitude, and I was going too fast, so I pulled the throttles back, put in a bunch of rudder to try to stop my rate of closure, and one of the engines stalled, and I had to relight it. I meant to look these numbers up before this, but maybe somebody knows. There were over 100 F-14s lost, and I found a website, actually, that show where in the world that happened and the dates and some places the names of the crew. We lost a lot of airplanes, most of them, almost all of them, in peacetime, all except for the Desert Storm. And a lot of them were engine-related. I don't know how that rate compares to other airplanes. I meant to look up the number of F-14s that were built compared to the numbers that were lost. It's a pretty high number, I think. Over 100 were lost, and I think maybe 1,500 were built. That's a good question. I don't know the answer. So John, F5s will still fall leaf apart today. I only got a ride in the backseat of an F5, so I'm no expert. But, yes, I have heard about when we would brief. What would happen is when we were doing DACT with an F5, the procedure is you always ran through your out-of-control departure procedures. Somebody would be designated to stand up and recite them by rote. Stick forward, neutral, lateral, harness lock was the first thing you did in the F-14. And the F-5 drivers, the adversary pilots, would then run through their procedures, and those procedures included what do they do if there was a falling leaf maneuver. So that's why I know that it was a problem in that airplane, because they always briefed how they would deal with it. Stein Peterson asked me, F-14 versus F-18, pros and cons. The F-14, both a pro and a con, because it was a lot bigger, it carried a lot more fuel, could carry a lot more bombs, could go a lot farther. We call them often the big fighter and the little fighter. So the advantage of the F-14 was all that. I'm personally a fan of two guys in the airplane. There are two-seat F-18s, but they're about half and half split. So I would view the F-14 Pros as two seats, a much more powerful radar. The F-14 radar could see a lot farther out than an F-18 radar can. Although, I guess a maneuvering target, the F-14 radar wasn't as good. The F-18 radar was very good at tracking maneuvering targets, but not as good as finding them further out. And I don't remember the numbers, to be honest. But an F-18, once you got within his range, it was hard to get away from him because that radar would hold on to him. The F-18 is a lot more maneuverable. easier to fly. Fly-by-wire, it's not as fast. It doesn't accelerate as fast. So I'm biased. Overall, I like the F-14 better. I thought it was a great platform. The downside is, because it is so big, it's easy to see. And in a dogfight with lots of other airplanes, you could lose sight of an F-18 a lot before you lose sight of an F-14. So that was obviously a downside. The F-18 was easier to land on the aircraft carrier. That's another plus. Easier to work on. A lot more digital stuff. A lot fewer man hours to maintain it. That's really why the F-14 went away, is it took a lot of time and money to keep them flying. John Ellis got the F-35C back after an engine fight. And what happened? Yeah, refueling. So I read about that too. And that's a problem. The F-14, it's happened. There's one video where the F-14 is refueling from a KC-135, and the hose broke off, and a lot of fuel got ingested down the intake, and the engine compressor stalled, flames coming out the front, destroyed the engine, but the pilot had another one to come home. Same with the F-18. There was a great story of in my Japan Air Wing. F-18 pilot comes up to the KC-135. He plugs, gets his probe in the basket, and the basket broke off and was stuck onto the refueling probe. So he's flying. He's still got the probe out, and he's got the basket stuck on the end of the probe. And the pilot, who's a friend of mine, had a great presence of mind to turn on his video recorder, and he got the tanker crew on tape saying that it was not his fault, that must have been something wrong with the basket. So he turned the tape off. Then when he landed on the ship with that basket still stuck on his probe, he went down to the CAG and he said, "CAG, it wasn't my fault. Here's the tape." And then he got to keep the basket. And that basket, when you're trying to plug it at 30,000 feet, it doesn't look very big. You put it in your room, it's probably 3.5 feet across and heavy. So the F-35, in my opinion, as you fly more and more of it, FODs are not uncommon. You could FOD it with a bird. You could FOD it on a runway. You could FOD it on a refueling probe. And having only one engine, my opinion, is going back to the old days. But I can't fix that. And the F-35, if you've ever heard one, they're really loud, too. And the F-35B, the one the Brits bought, you need to look at how that exhaust goes from straight down, and then it comes back up to the straight level mode, from the vertical takeoff mode to the flight mode. I think it's got lots of moving parts. That's going to be pretty interesting. And it's got the lift fan, too. But if you live near an airfield where the F-35 flies, stand by for the noise complaints. Louis Farrer, how did you train to visually distinguish good and bad guys' bandits during a multi-plane in-close engagement? Really good question. And sometimes you don't get it right. The F-14 was easy because when it's in a dogfight, the wings are generally going to be out. The telling the difference between an F-18 and an F-15 is tough, particularly from 2 miles away across the circle in a fight. But you get used to it. You just look at the plan form and primarily what the wings look like. We had a visual system, an IRST and a camera system on the F-14, the later F-14s, and you could get a radar lock, and then you could slew your camera and then get a picture of what that radar contact was. And you could get pretty good at picking out, does it have a single tail or two tails? So that was one way to tell. But it's a problem. And the problem today, because we don't have very many adversary squadrons, is when you're doing DACT for training, it's very often an F-18 against another F-18. That's why you always like to have dissimilar engagements so you can tell the good guys from the bad guys. And the F-4, also the F-4 smoked a lot, so you could tell it was an F-4 from the smoke sometimes. Uh, can't tell his name. There's no name here. But did you ever get to fly drive the F-14B? I did in my air wing tour with the F-102. Awesome airplane. So it had all the great attributes of an F-14A with the swing wing, the range, the speed. But you didn't have to worry about managing the throttles to avoid a compressor stall. You can move the throttles back and forth like you can in an F-18 without getting a compressor stall. So the F-14B, much faster, and you could fight it more easily without worrying about compressor stalls. In the F-14A, again, you would leave it either in military power or full afterburner, and you kind of leave it there because if you had a lot of angle of attack on the airplane and you pulled the throttles back, you could get compressor stalls. In the B, that problem was pretty much solved. They should have gone to that engine way earlier in the program, and that was actually the plan. The TF-30 was never intended to be the engine to stay with the airplane, excuse me, but because of money, they kept cutting out that engine upgrade, and the F-14B, somebody else can maybe tell me, but we were testing it in the early 80s, but it didn't show up to the fleet until the 90s, and the airplane had already been in the fleet for nearly 20 years. Okay. Mike JF, what was the Phantom like to land on a carrier in a rolling sea in the dark? Yeah, no kidding. Well, not just the Phantom, every airplane. I think this is urban myth, might be true, but there was apparently a study done during Vietnam where they wired the pilots up with blood pressure, heart rate sensors, and they measured those heart rates and pulse and breathing and all that in combat, feet dry, getting shot at, and landing on the ship at the end of that mission at night. And blood pressure and heart rates were higher landing on the ship than over the beach getting shot at. So landing on the ship at night in particular was always a challenge. Nobody really likes it. If it's a clear night and you can see the ship from a ways off, then I was fairly comfortable because you weren't chasing lineup. But we've all landed sometimes where you don't see the ship until it's could be 100 feet with a quarter mile visibility. You don't see the ship until the last couple seconds. Lots of YouTube videos of that. It's a testimony of the toughness of landing on a carrier. But the F-4 compared to the other ones, it was easier in some respects because the landing speeds were faster. So there wasn't as much time to make mistakes. And because the flight controls were more normal, unlike an F-14 with the differential tails, it was easier to land on the ship than the F-14 was. The reason the F-14 is called the turkey is because when it comes aboard the ship and those tails are moving and the big wings are moving, it flies like a turkey. The F-18, on the other hand, pretty easy to fly aboard the ship, relatively speaking, to the other ones. The heads-up display makes it a lot easier to fly the F-18. The F-14 had a heads-up display, but it was pretty much useless for landing on the ship. And the F-4 had no heads-up display, which is actually because I learned on the F-4, when I got to the F-18, we would train to practice to land on the ship without a HUD, and I was always pretty good at it because I had done that in the F-4, and the younger guys that only flew the F-18, we call them HUD cripples. If you didn't have the HUD, they had a hard time flying, but I trained that way, so it wasn't all that bad. All right, so Craigie Boy is playing hooky from work. He's listening in, and he's not at work, so good for him. By the way, same with me. It's about 4 o'clock here on the East Coast. I live in Virginia, and I'm supposed to be at work too, but I'd much rather be doing this. There are some great videos of landing on a pitchy rolling deck. There was a PBS special, you could probably find it, on super carriers. And there's a section in there of pitchy rolling deck, worst I've ever seen. And it was on the Nimitz. In my opinion, they made a huge mistake to go flying that day. I knew the guy who was a CEO of the carrier at the time. They wanted to go practice, and they launched during the day. And it was the deck was moving plus or minus 30 feet. It was rolling back and forth, and they had a hard time getting people aboard. So then they canceled the last two launches, but they still had airplanes airborne that they had to catch, about 12 of them, at night on that same pitching rolling deck. It's a great video to watch. Everybody's in the ready room is watching as these guys are trying to get aboard. And a great leadership piece of that was there was a young female pilot who was scheduled to fly on the last mission to fly the tanker. And she wasn't looking forward to that. So her commanding officer said, don't worry about it. I'll take that mission. And this is all in the video. And he took the mission, so she didn't have to. Showed great leadership, in my opinion. He gets airborne, and he had to do some refueling to get some of the other airplanes aboard. Everybody eventually got aboard, but it's a great example of of what it's like to land on a pitching rolling deck. John Ellis asked me if I know snort snodgrass. I do. I should go get a beer. Everybody in the F-14 community knows him, and he still works. My assistant's bringing me some water. Everybody knows Snort, and he's still flying in the airshow business today. It's not a beer, but it's better than nothing. All right, so ask about my first interview. I made a big mistake on that when I caught it, when I watched it. And some of my squadron mates that I'm on Facebook with, I settled for the F-14B and, in VF-154, and I didn't. 154 never got the B. They transitioned to F-18s later. Sorry about this. I'm getting over cold.
I'll just interrupt you there, Phil. So are you happy to go on for 15 minutes? Because that means we've, you know, hit an hour. Because obviously I don't want to take you up any longer if your voice is hurting.
No, I'm fine. I apologize for the coughing. But, yeah, as long as the questions are still here, let's keep going.
Are you sure? Because I just don't want to push you, that's all, because I don't want to ruin your voice for the day. Okay, guys, yeah, we'll keep the questions going, and we'll see how it goes.
So Miko is asking me, thanks, got a cough drop now. Did you ever fly the Cobra maneuver in an F-18? the answer is no, and I've never seen it done. If you don't know what the Cobra maneuver is, if here's the F-18, what the SU-35 does, in air shows anyway, is it rotates past the vertical, like the Cobra snake, and then back. I've only seen that done in air shows. F-18s have never done it. The challenging part is compressor stalls. So it's a fun maneuver to watch in air shows, but tactically it makes no sense, because if you were in a dogfight and the airplane did that, I would just point my nose at him and shoot him. So tactically it doesn't make any sense. For air shows, it's great for air shows. My best day in an airplane, any day, when the weather's nice. I still love to fly today. There was really no one best flight I could tell you. I really did enjoy flying in the Navy. I still enjoy flying today. Probably one of my worst days flying was we were flying out of Guam, daytime, four planes on a bombing training mission. Knew the weather was bad. So we saved some gas. We got back to the field. There was this huge storm rolling over the field. And I wasn't sure we were all going to get back to Guam. There's no place else to land. There's the Air Force base and a commercial field. Basically, that's the only places we could land. So I was the squadron commander at the time. Sent the guys with less fuel down first. I came down last. And as I came down and I broke out, you could see the ground. I could not see in front of me at all. It was raining so hard, I couldn't see out the front windscreen. So I had to look out both sides. And I basically, big wide runway, 300 feet wide, intended for B-52s. And I just sort of split the difference between the sides of two runways and landed. But there was so much water on the runway that I stopped pretty fast. So we all got down. I was nervous about getting everybody down. And then we taxied back over to the parking area, and it's still pouring rain. And my maintenance officer was in a truck, and he's worried about it too. And he pulls up. He was a big smoker. And he pulls up in his truck, and there was so much smoke in the truck from him smoking cigarettes that I couldn't even see him. And then he opened up the door, and this big cloud of smoke came out. But he was glad to get all the airplanes back too. So there lots of sea stories, but flying is great. I still love it today. I'd like to do it every day if I could. Okay. Did I ever do DCT with a MiG? Have donut. I did. Back in the day, I don't know if that's classified or not anymore. But for training, I did have one training mission where I flew against a real MiG. I learned a lot from that. That was a long time ago. The MiGs back in the day, you know, the MiG-19, MiG-17, MiG-21, had great capability, but they had a lot of limitations. Very short range. Their weapons were terrible. Visibility out of them wasn't very good, but they were effective. But mostly they were just short range that really limited them. Okay, here's a technical question. What's the wing loading of the Tomcat when the wings are 68, 83, 85 versus an F-16? I have no idea. Yeah, F-16 is a great airplane. It's a testimony to... I was involved when I was flying F-4s to when they were testing the F-16. So that was back in the early 80s. And they're still building them today. So the F-16 is a great airplane. The U.S. Air Force uses it primarily as a bomber, not as a fighter. We got F-15s for that. Again, kind of short range, but F-16 is a great airplane. Tough to beat in a dogfight, that's for sure. John Ellis, Canadian Space, their demo F-18. Yeah, I have seen that Canadian F-18. It is nice. F-104 lost a lot of them too. You're right. Brian W., in your opinion, should Navy have pursued the Super Cat? It's hard to say. Hang on a second. I skipped a whole bunch here. So there was always talk about what could we have done to the F-14 to make it better. You never could reduce the size of it. Difficult to maintain. So should we have gotten rid of it? Yeah, probably. The Super Hornet is a great airplane too, and it brings, because it's bigger than a regular Hornet, it brings back a lot of what the F-14 had in terms of range and payload and all that. So the Super Hornet is a great fit for the Navy today. So getting out of the Tomcats was probably the right call. I never did have to eject, knock on wood. The closest I came, I had a near midair one time in a dogfight. We both came really close to each other, survived that with no damage. But other than that, I never had any serious engine fires or low fuel, anything like that. So that midair was my closest, but never had to eject. Air-to-air FLIR adds a lot to the SA. F5s, yeah. The FLIR, forward-looking infrared, does add a lot. F-18s are adding it now. It also helps you in a stealth mode if you can find somebody with your radar turned off, because a radar obviously gives you up. So FLIR is another way to look for particularly stealth fighters today. So FLIR is a and so IRST, the F-14 infrared search and track was a great tool. And even in the F-4, we had a rifle scope it was sitting up on the glare shield, and it was bore sighted to the radar. So you could, if you had a guy in radar, you could look through that rifle scope and try to pick him up visually. Admiral Tom Connelly gave his career to tell the truth about the TF-30. That's very true. He was the program manager of the F-14 at the time, and there's testimony of him testifying in Congress about the TF-30 being a lousy engine, and he spoke the truth, and that's what happened. User here says F-14 wasn't retired because of maintenance. There was a lot of politics involved. The story is that the Secretary of Defense at the time didn't like Grumman and punished him by canceling the F-14. There's some truth to that, in my opinion, but politics were involved. There's a lot of politics in the whole defense world, who gets what contracts, and between Lockheed and Northrop Grumman and Boeing back in the day. So that was part of it, and it was Secretary of Defense Cheney, I think. He wasn't a fan of Grumman, so that was part of it. Puke and George, you think the F-14 would still be a good fighter today with modern? Yes, we've talked about that a little bit. Quick Strike was one of the proposals. It was a good airplane when it was retired. A very capable radar, Lantern pod, GPS weapons, long range, two guys in it. Upgrades have been happening throughout, particularly the Lantern pod, GPS weapons. The F-14 would still be a good fighter today. Its biggest drawback today, is the radar cross section is the size of a barn, and that really is a problem. It's easy to see on the radar. It's easy to see visually. That's hard to hide compared to more modern fighters. Even like the F-16 is easier to hide, and then of course the stealth fighters, F-35, etc. So the F-14 was still a great airplane, but it is still old technology. RL661, ballpark endurance time of the F-14 during cap without refueling. We could routinely fly off the ship. We would fly 2-hour cycles. So you could take off, fly your mission without refueling, go out to a cap station, cap, and come back to the ship with plenty of gas. We didn't refuel during a 2-hour mission. The F-18s, on the other hand, generally an hour and a half cycle, and they would generally have to refuel for that. Flying it off the beach, you could go even longer because you didn't have to keep that reserve of fuel that you had to when you're landing on the ship. So a 2-hour cap cycle was a piece of cake for the F-14.
Okay, so just before we go on, I just want to let everyone know we've got 10 minutes left. Are you okay with that, Phil?
I'm okay with that.
Right, we've got 10 minutes left, so Phil can answer as many questions as you can, yes. But get them coming in.
Yeah, I'll try to go a little bit faster here. So, yeah, PBS series is called Carrier. That's good. If you look that up, it's great. The F-14 cannot go supersonic with the wings extended. So the faster you go, the wings start coming back on their own. Stork does still fly the A-4s with a company called I can't think of it. It's a private company that owns a lot of A4s that they fly for adversaries.
Is it Draken?
Draken, yeah. So Snort still flies for Draken. One of my LJs used to fly for Draken. The owner's a rich guy that bought a bunch of New Zealand A4s, and Snort still flies them. Good for him. RAF F-35s are coming. The U.S. Marines are flying them now out in Japan. Air Force is fine, and the Navy is not yet. They're supposed to IOC them next year, I think. The paralysis of the TF-30, I think, yeah. Terrible. It was a terrible engine, turbofan, better on gas, but a terrible engine. The GE engines are much better, and that's what the F-14 finally got and needed it. You still get to go up in a jet occasionally? No. I did get to fly an extra 300 acrobatic airplane, which was as good as you could get without a jet, in my opinion. If anybody owns a jet and wants to take me for a flight, I'd be happy to take you up on that.
Likewise.
Is there a calculated formula used to come around directly on a Bandit 6 from a head-on? There is no calculated formula. You could talk for hours about one circle where you go same circle, or two circle where you go opposite circle. It depends on if your airplane has a better turn rate. In other words, how fast the nose turns, or turn radius, how tight it turns. So depending on your airplane, what the Bandit's airplane is, you either want to do a rate fight or a radius fight and go vertical out of plane. There is no calculated formula for it, so it depends. Okay, Miko says the Finnish F-18s can do the Cobra maneuver. I've not seen that. I'd like to see that. He says it's because the FCSs were updated with an MLU package. I don't know what that is. So I didn't know that. I would think it'd be an engine problem, but apparently not. I don't know what the Finns are going to replace it with, if it's F-35s or what they're going to replace it with. I love the Rifle Score. Yeah, it was still true. Or talk about the Cobra maneuver. Yeah, Draken, thanks for that, John. And there's other companies. There's Draken, there's Tac Air, they bought some F-5s. And there's Top Aces, they bought some old F-16s. And they're all trying to get in the business of commercial companies flying adversary support. And so John and Mika going back and forth thought the F-18 was limited to 35 AOA. That's what I thought too, but I guess they fixed that. Draken. F-14 can go Mach 1. Yeah. The F-14 can go Mach 1.1 before the wings start coming back. I can pull out my book, but I don't think that's true. Now, they started programming back at about 0.8, as I recall, but the F-14 cannot go Mach 1.1 with the wings out. For design, okay, there's some debate about that. I don't believe it. Have I ever fired in anger? I have dropped a bomb in anger, but I've never fired a missile in anger. I've shot a lot of missiles in training. I shot down a full-scale F-86 drone in training, but I've only dropped bombs in anger. Very few air-to-air missiles have been shot in anger lately, although there was a mid-kill in over Syria, an F-18 guy, and there was a couple kills from F-14s, during Desert Storm. A lot more kills from F-15s in Desert Storm, but very few F-14 guys have ever shot a missile in anger. And I was too late for Vietnam with F-4. Midlife update. Okay, thanks. That's what MLU is. Hardest 1v1 pilot you ever fought? He was my CO at the time. His name is Rat Willard. He was actually in the Top Gun movie as the MiG pilot. When you see the MiG pilot inside the cockpit view, you actually find an F-5. But that's a Rat. We'll call him Rat. Rat Willard, best 1v1 pilot I ever fought against. And he retired as a 4-star admiral. Great guy. Did you ever see an F-18 dancing on his rudders in close? The rudders on an F-18 were all connected. So yeah, you had rudder control, but the pedals don't move. It's all about pressure on the rudders. So when you move the stick in an F-18, the wing flaps and the wings move, and so do the rudders, and they're automatically towed in for landing. So I've not actually seen her do a rudder dance. F-18s were very stable coming aboard, I guess. Ultimate weapon system, the F-14 would have performed if Cold War task. Yeah, so that's what the F-14 was designed for. six Phoenix missiles, although we rarely flew with six, most normally with two, a radar that could see a long way, and a missile that would go a long way. And the way it worked is the missile would come off, and it would go up to, 80,000 feet and then come straight down. So it was hard to defend against. Did you drive the IRST with a second throttle? No, the way the IRST worked was you got a radar contact, and then you could point the IRST at the radar contact. If you tried to find a target with just the IRST, that was tough to do, but the Rio did all that. Yeah, Rat, he's a legend. John Ellis knows him. Pete Pettigrew, another good guy. Pete Pettigrew was a consultant to Top Gun movie. He's actually in the bar scene where Kelly McGillis is sitting at a bar and she's waiting on her boyfriend when Tom Cruise is trying to pick her up. That's Pete Pettigrew. He's in the movie. Okay, somebody else was saying that F-14s can do Mach 1 with the wings at 20. Yeah, I'll have to look that up. I don't believe it. Okay, I think maybe the last question. What's your technique for the burble behind the ship? So I'm going to describe it first. The burble is essentially how the air behind the carrier gets disrupted. And if a ship is making its own wind, the burble then comes directly behind the ship and you have to fly through it. If there's lots of natural wind, what's happening is the wind is coming down the angle deck and then it drops off the back of the deck and then it kind of pops up. So the burble is the air flow disruption behind the ship. You just have to plan for it. So what you didn't want to do, if the pilot was a little bit high coming down and taking power off when he's getting to the burble, you had to get, as an LSO, had to get him to come back on the power quickly. So the worst part was I'm a little bit high, power's coming off, now I hit the burble. So the technique was just keep the power up and don't get sucked into that burble.
So I just want to thank everyone for being in the chat and thank you to Filthy himself for joining us. And maybe we can get you on again sometime, Phil?
Sure. You can give him my email address if you'd like to, Mike, and if they want to, any other questions, happy to do it. Love talking about airplanes. Love talking about F-14s.